Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today, delighted to be joined back on Reboot Republic by Mark Smith, who is a chartered clinical psychologist and also past president of the Psychological Society of Ireland. Mark, thanks for joining me again on Reboot.
I'm delighted to be back. I mustn't have screwed up too much last time. You have me back again.
Well, I wouldn't say that now, but you're back.
Okay, but either way, I'm back.
You're back, exactly. Yes, you said something that was definitely listeners enjoyed and found interesting. So they were egging me on to get you back. So I said, despite my best instincts, I said, okay, we'll go.
Oh, look, you got to give the fans what they want.
Exactly. But in all seriousness, no, you have a huge amount to contribute, and I found it, you know, I really enjoyed the last times we had you on, and I know the listeners did as well, because, you know, the truth is, as you know, in terms of your work and life and everything, is that, you know, we are in a mental health crisis again, and this is a pandemic crisis upon a previous mental health crisis. You know, where are we at again now? And I asked you the last time, the last lockdown, and, you know, where do you think people are at? Like, you know, where are we at?
I think mental health wise, you know, at the time when we chatted last time, it was at a crisis, and then you think, you know, it can't get much more difficult than that, but it has. Certainly speaking to colleagues, I actually had a call across the country on Wednesday with psychologists, and it's replicated everywhere. Referral rates through the roof, but not just the numbers of referrals coming through, but how much people are struggling. And we just don't have anywhere near the resources to meet that need. And it's hard. I'm kind of thinking it's 3 weeks into January going, how are we going to keep this up? Because I work as a team coordinator on a team, and just the amount of parents who are ringing, with each parent with a distressed child wanting help for their kids. And they're all very, very genuine and needing help now, but you just don't have the numbers to do what they need to get that help. So it's hard not to take that on board and not to feel that. But you know, it's where we're at, and I worry about how much more there is to come, and that it feels to me personally like our mental health services are at breaking point in terms of trying to meet the need that's out there. There's just so much of it. And I just don't see where the extra resources are going to come from, and what that's going to be like for people.
And what sort of things are how are people presenting the level of, you know, in what way is it?
Predominantly anxiety would be, I think, the biggest thing we're looking at. And that's not uncommon to feel anxious in a global pandemic with uncertainty, isolation and no end in sight. So that's not particularly surprising. I think what's caught a lot of us by surprise is the rate and presentation of young people with eating disorders, with anorexia in particular. Yeah. So we used to get, you know, a couple a year, which was okay. You know, we could manage that. But from my own experience and from speaking with colleagues, the last number of months were just inundated with young people as young as 10, 11, 12, 13, who are presenting with not just kind of early onset kind of anorexia, but full blown crisis with severe weight loss, where medically they're at risk, and the families are in crisis point, and our hospital departments, in terms of kind of medically stabilizing these children or inpatient units, are beyond capacity. And I suppose of all of the issues that we work with young people in particular with, anorexia is the one that we worry about perhaps the most, because it has a higher mortality rate than people who experience suicidal ideation because of the direct physical impact it has on the body, but also how much it entrenches young people's views about, you know, their body image and about a sense of control. So it gives a false sense of illusion that, you know, if I control my eating, I restrict it, I control my weight, that it gives me a sense of control that I'm missing in other parts of my life. But it's a very false sense of control, because what happens is that the more that the person loses weight, the more that, you know, parents and the system have to step in and take charge and take control. And it's worrying, I suppose, to see, and it's scary and it's hard to see young people lose so much weight and still believe that they're fat. It's a very debilitating, overpowering mental health issue that places families under huge stress, but also the system in trying to support and respond to them. So I suppose that's the one that we didn't see coming as a result of COVID, but the one that causes us the most concern.
And of course it is. It's deeply distressing. And why do you think that is?
I don't think we know yet. I think we're still in firefighting mode, trying to respond to the needs that are there. And we just don't have the time to stop and reflect and think about what may be the contributing factors. My instinct is just the degree of uncertainty and lack of control that's out there. So I can't control what's happening, you know, when COVID is going to end, if we're going to go back to school, if I'm not going to back to school. And it's, you know, they're anxious. And when we're anxious, we want certainty. We want control. And if a young person gets that little bit of a taste of control or perceived control over restricting their eating, then they want more of it. But they don't see, and they can't see the pathway that it's leading them to is a very dangerous one. But it's something that we have to respond to. We have to prioritize, because it's one of those issues that it's not just about the mental health, but it directly impacts on the physical health too, and puts people really, really physically at risk. And I think it's... the thing that's made it harder for me has been just some of the recent kind of media coverage that has shown us that last year, only a fraction of what was allocated to the eating disorder specialist teams was spent. And it was a recent newspaper today, actually, that showed that there was no additional funding provided in 2020. So, you know, if we're looking at a mental health issue that has the highest lethality rate of anything, you kind of wonder, you know, where is the money going and why isn't it being spent on this priority? Because it impacts on young people, families, adults. It's incomprehensible why this isn't a priority for funding.
It absolutely is. And for parents then who are dealing, you know, and trying to support their children in those contexts and in the broader context of anxiety, because it is, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because, you know, parents, as you say yourself, you know, are hugely stressed themselves and hugely anxious. And there can be no doubt, of course, that our children feed off that as well. And literally, like, you know, our reflections of that, and both, you know, we try to protect them from it. But I know that there's, you know, a huge amount of stress out there in families, people trying to, you know, deal with so many, you know, situations of, be it working or be it, you know, trying to homeschool or be it, you know, look after, you know, caring, and all just in such an isolated way and in such a lack of, you know, with such confined ways as well. What is there any advice? And again, I feel really hard, you know, asking this, because I know there's so many systemic problems, but, you know, for a parent, is there things that they can do to try and help themselves and help their children in this time?
I think the first thing I would say is about being kind of compassionate towards yourself as a parent. One of the things that I noticed pre-COVID, and I think even more so since then, is an increasing pressure on parents to be this idea, this symbol of a perfect parent, that you have to be all things to all people, and that if you're not, then it's not good enough for your kids. And that's been there for a while. I think that's only increased during COVID, because not only now are you expected to be kind of a good parent, but now you have to be a teacher, you have to protect them, you have to be all things to all people, while you're also under incredible stress yourself. Yeah. So I think it's really hard for parents to come to terms with the idea of being good enough, that they expect that they need to be perfect, that they need to prevent their children from getting distressed, because if they do, or if they don't prevent them from getting distressed, that it might be seen as, you know, you're not being a good parent. But I would argue that part of being a good parent is that you're okay with your child kind of being distressed, because sometimes it's a normal reaction, and that you're teaching your child how to experience emotions in a safe and supportive way with you, so that later in life, when they're not with you and they're exposed to difficult emotions, they have a reference point for what that feels like, and that it's not a bad thing to hide your emotions or to have to suppress them from others. So I think for parents, it's about kind of, and I think over time, because maybe just how long COVID has gone on, parents have had to adapt their standards and expectations out of necessity. Because, you know, say, for example, I don't know what it's like for my house. You kind of come to the conclusion that the house looks like an atomic bomb has hit it most of the time. And you know what? So bloody what? When they're gone to bed and you've got the chance to eat and breathe for a second, you kind of look around and you go, yeah, I'll put away a few toys now, and so what if it's not this picture perfect house? It's all right. We got through the day. We all survived, you know, without too much conflict. We got a bit of work done. I hopefully managed to get a bit of work done if you're working from home, and the kids learned a bit, and nobody killed each other, you know, that we survived the day. And I think we've got to that point where we almost kind of look at each day and go, how do I get through today? Not be thinking about kind of exams and future achievement and looking too far into the future, rather than just today as a unit, as a family unit, whatever that unit looks like. How do we get through it okay, safely, and preserve, you know, our relationships? Because I think there's an understandable piece that there's people are a little on edge because of COVID, and they're cooped up in environments together. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to live in a standard, you know, 3-bed house, but there are families who don't. They've could have 3 or 4 or 5 kids in a 2-bed apartment, and they're literally on top of each other. So, you know,
or in hotel rooms, in hotel rooms, or family hubs in
wherever it's going to be. And these are not ideal scenarios to be in the best of times. But when you can't go outside and you're on top of each other, then that's an additional pressure. I think one of the things that's really struck me about kind of all of this piece around homeschooling is that there's been less conversation this time around digital poverty and about, you know, parents trying to do their work from home if they're lucky enough to be working, but also then their kids needing to do schoolwork on whether it's Google Classroom or Seesaw, or I've lost track of the amount of apps.
Yeah.
You know, and how do I decide to do my work versus I need to give it to my kid to do the homework versus, you know, my kid wants to talk to their friends. And if you don't have those devices available, that's a really tough choice for a parent to make about who do I give the device to if we're not lucky enough to have them.
Mm, yeah, it is. And, you know, it's, I think as well, I think there's so many stress, you know, factors of stress and the levels of stress that people are under. And particularly, you know, I've talked at a couple of podcasts on parenting already, around, you know, listening to parents. And, you know, I know it myself as well that, you know, your level of kind of thinking, as you say, like, I feel it, like, you know, every day you're listening to news going, you know, when are the schools going to be back? When is, you know, when are things going to open up? You know, when will the kids be able to, you know, birthdays are coming up. When will the kids be able to have birthdays? When will they be able to meet their friends? When will they, you know, get back into school, get back into routines? And, you know, I find that it's hard sometimes to keep your lid. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to not, you know, blow up, and it's hard to not get cranky, and then kids are upset and you're upset, and it sometimes then feels you try to shut it down because, you know, you don't want people to be, you know, you don't want the kids to be upset, and it's kind of hard to manage it, isn't it?
It is. And I found, I've spoken about this before, that for myself, I used to kind of judge myself, you know, to probably a ridiculously high standard in terms of this expectation that because you give advice to parents as a psychologist, that you're supposed to be really good at following that advice you know, never make any mistakes, which was, you know, which is kind of ridiculous when I look at it, because it was a colleague actually pointed out on Twitter that being a psychologist absolutely does not make you a better parent, but definitely being a parent makes you a better psychologist, because it's not about the textbooks. It's about, you know, real people. And I think, there is times that we're going to be a bit more irritable, but we might snap, and that's because we're human, and that's okay. And I think the most important part for me, I think as a parent, if you're in that situation where you snap, is about how you do the repair, because the repair is where we kind of maintain the relationship. And I see it a lot with teenagers where they have a disagreement or a falling out with a friend as a teenager. That happens all the time. But then they get kind of catastrophic about it. And they think, you know, they've left me. I'm alone. I've got no friends. I'm a weirdo. You know, I'll never have a friend again.
Yeah.
Because they don't have much experience of how we manage conflict interpersonally. And that can happen at home and in a very safe way, because, you know, as a parent, I can have a disagreement with one of my kids and I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to abandon them or reject them. So they need to see that you can experience a difference of opinion as you're going to between parents and kids. And that even if you're cross with them, it's about the behavior and that we can have a repair.
Because it can be very challenging for parents. I'll speak for myself as well, you know, where you weren't, you know, managing conflict and dealing with conflict interpersonally is hugely challenging. It's triggering, it's upsetting, you either want to avoid it and then you let it build up, and you know, yeah, that we don't have the tools or skills to actually, you know, face conflict or to
I think all good podcasts have at least one point where someone disagrees, so I'm going to disagree with you on that.
Go for it.
I think we do. I think we have those skills available to us, but I think one of the greatest challenges of parenting is self-doubt, is where the parent doesn't believe that they have it, because I think they understandably care so much about their kids. They don't want to distress them, or they have this belief system that if I have conflict with my child, then, you know, in 10 years time, they're going to remember the trauma of it. And that day, daddy, that you gave out to me because I did this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to let you know the secret. They won't remember it. But what happens is we do, because we feel guilty. And we think that we've done the wrong thing because I haven't met the standard of parenting that I expected of myself. So, you know, if I wrote about this actually in a blog about that, parenting isn't a democracy. And sometimes in an effort to try and be good enough parents, we treat our kids like they're our friends, yeah, like they have an equal say, and, you know, they don't and they shouldn't. We do need to listen to them. We need to take their points of view into account, but we also need to lead, because if a child believes that they're on an equal footing with a parent or have more authority than the parent, then that's going to be the cause of conflict. So for a lot of things with parenting with kids, we don't need them to like what we're doing, but we do need them to accept it. So if your kid goes to bed at a particular time, say 8:30, and they're annoyed and irritable about the fact that they've been going to bed, but they accept it and they comply, then that's pretty good parenting. What happens is that we think that they need to see it from our point of view and to realize why they need to go to bed at that time. And that's just not how it works, because they don't see the world through our eyes.
In terms of, I suppose, the conflict thing, there's also, you know, that's conflict is one thing. There's also, I think, a real issue around, I think I feel it anyway, and it is connection, particularly with teenagers. And as they go through their different stages and, you know, development, and they go away from you, and, you know, you don't know what they're doing anymore. You don't know what they're talking, who they're talking to, how they're engaging. And it seems it's difficult, I think, for example, when they're, you know, maybe cranky or in moods, you're like trying to push and go, are you all right? Like, you know,
and yeah,
kind of going, just accepting, yeah, they have a mood, they'll come out of it. And then you go, at what point are they, you know, should you be pushing to see, well, do you want to talk to me about it? Or,
yeah, know? This comes up a huge amount. And especially, you know, one of the things that happens with me when I talk to teenagers is that I don't know is an acceptable response, but for, yeah, a lot of parents, it isn't. So, you, yeah, know, when you're talking to them and you see them that they're, you know, there's something up, as a parent, the instinct is I want to find out what's wrong and I want to fix it.
Yeah.
But sometimes the best thing to do is to just, I see you seem a bit upset, you seem a bit anxious or annoyed or frustrated, or, you know, you kind of give them the language to try and understand how they're feeling and say, look, if you want to have a chat, you know, I'm in the kitchen. Or if you want to, go for a drive, or do you want to have a walk? We don't have to chat. We could just go for a walk. Because what happens sometimes is that a parent will, with the best interests of their kid and trying to care for them, they'll follow them around. And, yeah, you know, are you okay? And can you tell me what's wrong? And why won't you tell me? And then they follow them and maybe follow them up to the room. And then they find out what's wrong. The kid is angry because the parent won't listen to them, which is just give me a bit of space. But parents are also worried, because they're worried if I leave them alone and they're very distressed, what could happen? And I meet an awful lot of parents who will kind of talk about, you know, I walk on eggshells around them because I'm afraid of asking them what's wrong, or that if I say the wrong thing, that something bad will happen and it'll be my fault for asking. But, you know, connecting with your child sometimes doesn't have to involve talking. It can just be being with them, and that can make them feel safe that, I, you know, you're not putting me under pressure. You're just being with me and accepting me for who I am right now in this moment. But also that the door is open, that if I want to talk, I can. And that gives them that sense of independence, which they need to developmentally, you know, have as a teenager, that they start to become independent or move away, you know, from the parents. But also that they know that the safety net is there, that, you know, if I go out there and if I make mistakes and if I'm allowed to make mistakes and I get something wrong, that, you know, my parents, my carers are there as that safety net to catch me when I fall, not to prevent them from falling. And I think that's maybe where the difficulties arise is that, again, some parents with the best of intentions want to try and prevent their teenager from falling, from making mistakes. But, you know, I look back at my own teenage years and we could be here for another hour if I was to list all the mistakes I made.
Only an hour.
Okay, maybe we'll move on. But, you know,
I could do a series on my own.
We forget when we get to this age, or my own age anyway, that you know, we made mistakes too, and that some of them were unpleasant, some upset us, some had consequences, but there were opportunities for us to learn from them. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it doesn't mean that if your teenager gets something wrong that you're a bad parent. It means that you're there to help them to understand it, to process the feelings that come along with it. So connection is about validating them, understanding them, and not trying to change them. Because as a teenager, developmentally, they're going through the most, you know, frequent changes in terms of identity and body and hormones and interests and likes and friends that they will ever go through in their lifetime. And when they feel how they are, that's how they feel in that moment. And that's okay. We shouldn't have this instinct to, I need to change it. I need to keep them going along a particular pathway. Because the developmental path of adolescence will weave and in and out and up and down and change constantly, like their emotions will. So for us, it's about kind of walking that journey with them, beside them, but not leading them. And as parents, we want the best for our kids and we think that we know what's best for them. But sometimes the best thing we can do is just be there beside them on that pathway. And if they need that extra helping hand, we're there to provide it, but we're not directing them.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely something that I think it was actually from our last conversation as well, that I've with my own teenagers kind of given him that space. And, you know, and I actually did that thing as well where, do you want to go for a walk? And we did go for a walk and I didn't pressure her to talk anything and we just chatted. And, you know, nothing really, you know, nothing of any significance or depth, but it was just a connection. And it's something that I didn't realize that, you know, you're better not to push and just, you know, say that, you know, just spend the time, actually just spending the time with them. And, you know, that definitely, you know, he valued it as well. But something I was going to ask you, is there a limit to how much you can give out to them?
Oh, here's a loaded question.
No, but I was thinking, like, you know, you talk about, all right, we're walking a journey with them, you know, and trying to support them and, you know, engage, you know, support them as we can and leave them be as well. But also, isn't there a role, or is there, for, come on, will you bloody empty that dishwasher, clean the dishes, clean the sink? You know, when you come down in the morning and the little kids are around, it's not okay to be just grumpy and cranky. You know, you need to put a bit of an effort in. And, you know, is there...
I think it's what's really important is that
nurturing? Because I think that's nurturing kind of, you know, concern for other people as well. And, you know, you're part of families and wider networks and not just stuck in yourself. That's important as well.
I think what's important is that you pick your battles, because when you said about, you know, can you give out to them about everything? No, you shouldn't, because there's lots of things you can just let go and let slide. And you got to pick on, you know, the two or three things that are really important. So I think maybe touching on what you're saying, respect. I think respect is one of those things that's non-negotiable.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can be cranky, you can, you know, you have those things and that's fine. But don't do it in a way that impacts on others or is disrespectful to others. But also if you pick too many battles, if you're, you know, arguing with them about everything or giving out to them about everything, what happens is you set up a dynamic where there's an expectation that this is going to be a row.
Yeah.
So if with mom or dad or wherever it's going to be, there's constant kind of arguing or giving out, when you get up in the morning, the expectation is, oh, here we go again. And that's the parent and the kid. That, you know, what's it going to lead? So you're primed and ready for battle. And then it's more likely to be a battle because that's what you expect.
Yeah.
And that's that kind of dynamic, that expectation between people is not good or healthy for anybody. But if a young person knows that there are certain things that, look, this is just non-negotiable. So respect being one of them, or going to school, or things about safety, you know, there is no discussion on those. So there's no point. So ironically, actually, if there's a couple of things that the parent just is immovable on, there is no negotiation, it actually makes the young person feel very safe and contained, because they know this is where the boundary lies. So we find that there, in very broad terms, there's kind of three styles of parenting. You have an authoritarian one where it's, you know, that old school, kids are to be seen but not heard, and it's just hammering them on everything. And that leads to pretty sad, distressed kids, because they're not allowed to flourish and be themselves. On the other end of the spectrum, you have kind of permissive parenting, where it's a free-for-all. There's no rules, there's no boundaries. It's, you know, let them just blossom and see where it goes. But they struggle too, because they don't know where the boundaries lie. And in life, there's always going to be boundaries, be that they go to school, it's a teacher, or they're out and about and a guard gives them a direction, or whatever it's going to be. And then I suppose that best ground that we all aim towards is that authoritative, where that we have that connection, but we also have this really clear communication style about, you know, we can have a bit of messing, but here's where the boundary lies, and trying to be consistent with that. And I think for me personally, and I'm talking to parents, that's the hardest part, is the consistency.
Yeah.
Because we're tired, or something's kicked off in work, or we're anxious about something. And for, you know, the amount of times over the years that I've had the conversation about, you know, just for the bit of peace.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, be that about screen time or chocolate or staying out later, or just to avoid conflict. But it actually leads to conflict then, because what the young person sees is that there's some flexibility in this boundary. And the best of kids, if they see a gap in terms of something that used to be quite consistent, they'll drive a truck through it, because, you know, it worked before.
Every day.
Oh, they do it to me.
Hardest thing as a
it's
parent,
so hard being consistent.
Being consistent, because you're like, 3 days in a row, right? No treats for whenever, or
yeah,
you know,
Friday,
only,
yeah,
20 minutes on the TV and that's it, or whatever it is, you know. And then the next day you're like stressed out, as you say, with work or whatever it is, and you're just like, oh, I could leave them, you know. And then of course,
yeah,
then it's like, what? But the last time you told me, I
and you go, all you can say is, yeah, you're right, you know. But that, you know, I did that because I was trying to do my meeting call, as my 3-year-old calls it when I'm up in the attic doing, daddy's doing his meeting call. But you know what? Daddy needs to say that this is what we need to do today. And I see you're annoyed, and yes, you're right, I did give it to yesterday, but today's a new day, and here's what's happening today. And it's that kind of giving that. But
and all I can hear in my ears is, wah!
Yeah, and you go, look, I can see, I can see, and that's. That's an understandable response. You know, they don't need to like our rules, but we have them because we put them in place with their best interests at heart.
Yeah.
And again, we're human, and we show that we're not perfect parents, and we get it wrong, and it's hard to get it right. But I suppose if you wake up and you think of, I'm going to do my best to be a good enough parent today, I think that's all any of us can aim towards. You know, some of my kids take great joy in pointing out things that I've got wrong and reminding me. When I was, oh, I don't know, my eldest daughter, when I think she was maybe 3, I was in Tesco and I was reaching up to get a bottle of wine, and my sleeve caught in the bottle, and I pulled 5 of them off the shelf. Now, the most impressive part of the story is I managed to catch 4, one of them hit the floor and smashed everywhere. And for years later, they would say, Daddy, do you remember when Daddy smashed the bottle of wine in Tesco and Daddy made a mistake? And, you know, I think it's still nice to show that, look, we all do things that happen. And, but except when my son then, who wasn't there at the time, reminds me, Daddy, do you remember when? I was like, you weren't there. What do you mean? You know, but again, it's that, look, things happen, mistakes happen, you know, when kids spill milk or something goes wrong and they break it, that, yeah, look, it's okay. And that you're not going to get in trouble. Things happen, and we'll manage it. We'll it'll be okay. And that, as parents, it's okay for us to be fallible too. And that's giving them a lesson that I think maybe ties back to like an earlier conversation about kind of perfectionism and expectations of what we have to be. And we see that with children, with young people with eating disorders, is that invariably they will have excessively high standards for what they have to be. I have to be perfect. And I think that if we can be compassionate with our kids as parents, and that we set good enough standards for them and communicate that, then that's a good message to send. Because in the absence of that, I've met an awful lot of kids where they set such huge expectations and standards of perfectionism. And the assumption from people and parents sometimes is that, you know, people will think I set them up, that they have to have all their A's. But a lot of it's actually the young person themselves, that they set this for me to be good enough. I have to get, you know, 98%, and if I don't, where did the 2% go? So by us as parents role modeling that this is this is good enough. And there's a principle from a program called DBT that we use. Marsha Linehan put it together. But one of the principles within it is in any given moment, and this is for parents or kids, the person is doing the absolute best that they can do in that moment. But it's also equally true that they can do better. So I think it has that lovely dialectic that encompasses that compassionate, we're doing good enough, and I think never more so than in a global pandemic, in a COVID, but there's always room for us to do something better. And it doesn't take away. Both things are equally true at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a very good way of framing it. I think the compassion as well, and trying to work on that and yeah. Compassionate to each other
But you know, I think most importantly to ourselves, you know, the amount of parents that I meet that would say, you know, I need to invest everything in my kids. And if my kids are happy, I'll be happy. And I have to have a really straight conversation with them and say, unfortunately, you got it backwards.
Yeah.
That if you're being as good as you can be, whatever that is, then that will pass on to your kids. And the analogy that I've used for years is the and it's ironic talking about this in the age of COVID, but when we could fly, when you sit down in the airplane and they go through the safety briefing and they say to you, in the sudden event of drop in cabin pressure, a mask will drop from the ceiling. And for those of you with small children, put your mask on first.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to do. We think that, you know, put everything, every drop of energy you have into your kids and it'll be okay. But then you've got nothing left for yourself.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, they need us. So self-care, self-compassion as parents will have a direct benefit for the kids. And you know, for parents to almost be a little bit selfish in looking after themselves, taking time out, minding them, you know, minding their own mental health, taking that bit of exercise. That's role modeling for the kids, but also parenting takes a lot of energy. It's exhausting. And I think never more so now because, you know, they're homeschooling and they're trying to work and they've just got so little energy. And then parents are not prioritizing looking after themselves because they're thinking about the lunches or what they need to do or all this kind of stuff. And it is really important for parents to prioritize self-care. There's a program that's run for children who engage in self-harm. It's called the SPACE program. It's run out of Temple Street by some amazing people. And they've been running it for many, many years. And it's a six-session program that supports parents. And what I love about the program that in each one of the sessions, one of the take-home messages is, what are you going to do to mind yourself?
Mm.
And parents are given homework tasks about looking after themselves. But my child, yes, if you look after yourself, your child will be in a better place because you're looking after you. So I think parents dealing with kind of the feelings of guilt that they have, you know, we need to address that. We need to talk about it because they need to take care of themselves better so that kids can see that, well, yeah, mommy, daddy need a timeout, or that mommy, daddy can get stressed and here's what they do about it for themselves when they get stressed. But yet we talk to them and we see them getting stressed and we ask them to do something, you know, positive to manage it, but they don't see us doing it. You know, I'll be grand. I'll do that later. And we don't get to it.
And of course, that also then highlights, you know, the inequalities within parenting, you know, for lone parent families, you know, or again, for people who are, you know, in serious poverty or, you know, in distress and in, you know, that the ability or the capacity to self-care, you know, is just, it's so restricted and it's so.
Yeah, I see it with parents, especially single parents or where there's poverty, that it's not about self-care, it's about survival.
Yeah.
Because they've got to be everything. They've got to manage the bills, do the housework. You know, there can't be equity of division of labor in the home because they are it. You know, for whatever reason that they're single parents, they're the one who's carrying all of that weight. And I see it. And, you know, when I talk to those parents, sometimes that conversation that we have is the only time that they get free to have a conversation, to talk, to vent. And sometimes for me with them, I think the most therapeutic thing I can do is just let them vent. Whatever emotion is coming, be that anger, sadness, frustration, it doesn't matter. Just a safe space that they can be with another adult and just let that emotion out that they feel that they can't around their kids because they're constantly trying to do everything they can to look after them and care for them. But I think in a lot of cases, yes, they're a single parent, but I think one of the strengths that we have in Ireland is our sense of community. The neighbors, the grandparents, the friends, if we're lucky to have them, that are there. But I've met other parents where they're almost ashamed to ask for help because I again, this back to the sense of being good enough, that the expectation is I should be able to do this myself, and that there's a sense of shame in asking for, can you help me out with this? But there isn't, you know, and it's great for kids to have, if they're around and available, aunts, uncles, grandparents, cousins, whoever it might be, to give mom or dad or whoever they are, if they're on their own, a break from things, if that's possible.
Of course, that's even more restricted now with COVID.
Which makes it so much harder, because we're short of those connections. We can't take in people and you know, drop the kids off for, you know, a play date for the night. Like, I had a conversation with my 3-year-old over breakfast this morning, and I don't think she fully understood it, but it kind of just really brought home for me how much they're really taking in. And she said to me, "Daddy, when COVID is over, can we have a sleepover?"
Yeah.
She's no idea what tomorrow is, never mind when it's over. But it just shows that sense of, even as really small children, that we assume all of this is going over their heads. It isn't.
No.
And what they're missing is that sense of connection.
Yeah.
And when I take my kids out for a drive, wherever we might be, go, I say, "Look, who do you want to talk to?" And they've listed between the different grandparents or the cousins, and we'll always have a chat, because they crave it. They need, as well as we do.
Yeah.
But that sense of community, that sense of family, if we're lucky enough to have it, they're the things that kind of regenerate us and keep us going. And I think we've really missed it.
Yeah, no, we have. And even another example of how coronavirus has impacted on them and entered every part of them. The 5-year-old and 6-year-old were running around playing a game today. And I was like, "What are you playing?" They were like, "Coronavirus." I was like, "What's coronavirus?" So basically one of them is the coronavirus and the other is running away from catching it. So there's no longer tag. It's now coronavirus.
Yeah, look, but it also, you know what, it shows the brilliant ability of kids to adapt and to find humor in the things that are there. And
yeah,
I had a lovely experience about maybe what, 10 days ago, and just another dark morning heading off to work, and you know, no end in sight, and there was a little snow flurry overnight, maybe, you know, an inch, 2 inches, very, very little. But the kids were dressed in their wellies and out the door before breakfast, just with absolute and utter joy.
Mm.
Look at this. And I think it was the 3-year-old's first experience of snow.
Yeah.
And you kind of think that in the midst of all of this stuff, the news that's there, we sometimes miss out on seeing these little things that just give people so much joy. And it, you know, it's never going to replace all of the stress, the anxiety, the grief that everyone has experienced this year. But when you can just sit in that moment and look at the world and something new and novel through a toddler's eyes, it just, you know, I never thought I'd be getting all warm and fuzzy in my old age, but it's just lovely.
It is.
You know, to experience it.
Absolutely. Nothing compares to it, to, you know, seeing them experience something different like that. And I say this on every podcast as well. Nature, their relationship with nature is quite something that is, you know, so good for them and positive. And again, like, you know, it's natural. It absolutely is. And you know, nature is, even in the inner city, you know, nature, there is nature around us in little parks and little corners. And when they go out and see it and they look up at a bird, or, you know, they poke a stick in a dirty pond, you know, they really just, they feel it. And it is amazing to get them out, and so important to get them out, if it's possible. But something I did want to ask you, just in terms of course, the inequalities of parenting experiences in lockdown. You know, parents of children with disabilities and with, you know, additional needs and special needs, and that they, you know, we know that they're really, really struggling. And what, you know, you, something specifically just to ask you first around, you know, what is your sense of, you know, as a society, how we're supporting them? Because I know there's a lot of focus on the schools, but also the schools aren't the only place that, you know, these families need support from. So maybe that first, and then I'll come on to ask you about the work you're doing around assessment of need, because I know that's something that
I think the way things have happened over the last 10 days, I think, has been really unfortunate and really unhelpful, because it's pitted, even within the kind of community of parents who have children with additional needs, it's pitted them all against each other. That things have been painted like it's a black and white thing, and it's not. And I was tweeting with this recently that, you know, there are some children who absolutely without a doubt benefit from the structure, the routine, the predictability of being in school. But there are also some children with additional needs for whom school is quite a stressful place, and that there will be anxiety about it. And it's not a one size fits all. So I think what I would have liked to come out of, or hopefully will still come out of this, is that for those children who will benefit from it, and the parents will know, they know their kids better than anybody, that they have that opportunity to go back into school and to be there, be with their friends, or be in a safe, predictable place. But also that for the parents who, if they've got underlying issues, or for the kids who actually it's not as safe or predictable or cause anxiety for them, that it's okay if they don't go too. So that we don't try and cast one big blanket over for everybody. But I think what sometimes has got missed in the conversations is that, yeah, you're right, it's not just about school. That within services that are out there, that, you know, therapists have been redeployed to different sectors, that they haven't been able to access supports in a way that they would have before. So across the board, I know that there has been some changes with some of the day services for adults with disabilities and coming back on board. But there are certainly gaps because of COVID. There are gaps pre-COVID, and there will be gaps after that. And I think they are some of our most vulnerable in society. And I think we've a long way to go, that if we're going to try and say that their rights are being respected, both in education, health, and ability to make them feel like valued members of society.
And I think that's a really, really important point, that we have a long way to go, you know, in terms of that. Where do you think are the kind of some of those key areas that need to be addressed that we know existed pre-COVID and but should be getting focused now as well, I think, and added into the discussion?
I think one of the difficulties that we have is how narrow a focus the Disability Act is in terms of trying to enshrine the rights of children with disabilities. So as it stands at the moment, the focus is all about kind of assessment. And, you know, so we'll maybe talk about that in a few minutes about the difficulties with that. But assessment only indicates what, when it's done right, only indicates what a child's particular needs are. Mm. What I would like to see happening is that there's an enshrinement of right to intervention.
Yes.
Because that's the thing that actually makes the difference. It's if you go into your GP or hospital and you get an x-ray and they tell you you've got a fractured leg, the automatic assumption is that they're going to do something about it. That, you know, that you will get a cast, you will get support for that injury. But what's happening within in our disability sector in many cases is that we identify need. So you need speech and language therapy, you need OT, you need physio, you need psychology. But do you know what? You're going to have to wait for that for a couple of years because we just don't have it. So I think just for parents, it just means so heartbreaking to wait for years to find out what the needs are. Then you're finally told, and then you're told that actually there isn't resources to meet the need that we've identified. You're going to have to wait again. So we're kind of setting up this hope and expectation. And we know that especially for young children, those early years are just so valuable in terms of providing them with the skills that they need. And I think probably no more so than communication.
Yeah.
So our speech and language therapy services are nowhere near what they need to be. And we're social creatures. Communication is core to all that we do. So if we get a young person who has maybe a receptive language difficulty, so they struggle to understand language, or expressive language where they can't find the words, then that's going to really impair them in so many different ways. So you might see a young person who has anger difficulties or gets frustrated. And you assume maybe that it's because they're being, and I hate this thing, bold or bad behavior. But if they're trying to express how they feel and they just don't have the words or what they want, then of course frustration is going to be the way they communicate. Or if the young person has a difficulty with, you know, the parent says, can you go upstairs, get your shoes, your bag and meet me at the car? And they've understood a quarter of it. They don't do it. The parents goes, oh, look, they're being bold again, and they're not. They just didn't get the language. And that's where our speech and language therapy services are so important, to give those communication skills early. But they're stretched really, really thin. The same with occupational therapy in terms of kind of the fine motor skills, the gross motor skills. So if kids are struggling with their handwriting, or if their coordination that gets in the way of them joining sports clubs where they could be with their friends, and they lose confidence because I don't know how to ride a bike like the other boys and girls are out there. You know, these are life skills that sometimes kids can have a delay in, that if we get them the early intervention, it can help them to fit in and to be less at risk of feeling isolated and developing mental health problems later in life. So we have to get better at early intervention, so that it's about an enshrinement in rights to support an intervention when you need it, and not just identifying what the needs are.
And in terms of that, you know, I think you're absolutely right. And it seems to be a clear gap. You know, you're enshrining the right to identify needs, but not the right to intervention, which would actually address that need.
Yeah.
It seems to be that, and we know that the services aren't there. And as you say, they're stretched, that it's a lot of lip service then. And it's something, you know, in this whole conversation again about the schools, it's like all this concern from government and about, you know, SEN, you know, and you're going, hang on a minute, like, you know, it rings hollow with the absence of, you know, a real commitment, a broader commitment to services for these children and families.
Yeah, because what we've seen for many, many years is that actually if children with additional needs are lucky enough to be in school, that for a lot of them, they will require additional support to keep them in school, to make that educational and social experience in there the best that it can be. There have been some pilot studies with kind of having speech and language therapists and OTs on site. And I think it's a wonderful initiative, because our teachers also need to be working as a team.
Yeah.
So with the profile of needs that many of these children have, it's not fair also to expect that teachers have to be both teachers, psychologists, speech and language therapists, OTs, all wrapped up in one. That you should work with children with these additional needs as a community, you know, as the parents working together, the teachers, the therapists, all working as one team. But that's an ideal scenario that unfortunately rarely is a reality, because we don't have enough of that. And what we want to avoid is that children are dropping out of school, they're not reaching their potential, whatever that might be, because of a lack of support and resources and intervention to help them to do that. And it's something that we're going to have to get right, because we're not at the moment. And I think what comes up an awful lot is that we just don't have enough investment. It's not about the teams or clinicians who are there working harder or doing more. You can only do so much with a limited pot. And, you know, these kids have, many of them, lifelong difficulties, and we need to stay with them. You know, we need to build those relationships, not just with the kids, but with the parents. Because if you can work with families and you equip those parents with the skills and the support to manage it, you equip them to be as good as they can be. But what we see is that parents have to devote years of their energy to fighting. To fight for their children's needs, to be part of advocacy groups, to go into Oireachtas committees, to write to their TTs, to go on social media, and have to put themselves out there to fight for what should be their children's right. So they're wasting, I think, so much time that they would be better spent being with their kids.
Yeah.
Having to put themselves out there and make themselves visible and vulnerable, because they've no other choice. And I have such admiration for them, but also sadness that they have to do it. But you know, a parent in most cases will do whatever it takes when it comes to their kids. And I think for parents of children with additional needs, be that autism or physical needs or intellectual, whatever it's going to be, they are, you know, they're warriors. I think if I was in the position of the, you know, getting the flack from them, I'd be terrified of the passion that they have, because they just have such endless love for their kids that they don't care being told no. They will keep going and going and fighting because they want to give their kids the best opportunity they can. But it always comes back to me that they shouldn't have to, but despite that, they keep doing it.
Yeah. And it is a real indictment of our society that, you know, these are some of the most, you know, vulnerable families, and they are just, you know, left not adequately resourced. You know, it really is, it's utterly disgraceful, you know, and it's.
And I've heard arguments being made at various times about, look, well, we have to just make the best of the resources that we have. And I refuse to accept that. That, you know, if we have, like, we look through the Celtic Tiger and all of the money that was flowing through the system, how much of that went into disability services? How much of that went into mental health?
Yeah.
I don't think anywhere near enough. And, yeah, and now we're playing catch up and wondering, you know, how are we going to do things different, better with the resources we have? And I don't think we have. And I think there was a report by the Ombudsman for Children, and he presented the Oireachtas a number of weeks ago about the assessment of need. And he used a great line that I've stolen from him since, that with the system that we have sometimes with resources, it's not about robbing Peter to play Paul. It's just robbing Peter.
Yeah.
And that's what it feels like, that we're just moving pieces on a, you know, the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Yeah.
Rather than going, we need to address the fundamental issue of there isn't enough resources available to meet these needs. And you know, maybe it's a Pollyanna existence, but wouldn't it be lovely to think of a situation, a time where a parent doesn't have to sit down at nighttime and think, right, what TD do I need to write to? What posts do I need to put on Twitter? What radio show do I need to go on to fight for my child, that I can just be a parent and be with my kid? Like that, it's, you know, maybe it's a rose-tinted glasses idea, but I don't think it's an ideal that we should let go of. And that, you know, if we need to fight for it, we fight for it. Like, I don't work in disability services. I haven't done in 18 years. But I feel that I have a responsibility as a psychologist and as someone who spends probably too much time on social media, that I need to join in that fight with them. That parenting can be a lonely thing. And I think for parents who are having to have these fights, to see people kind of stand up with them and say, look, yeah, I'll fight with you. It won't be popular, and it won't win me any popularity contests probably in the powers that be, but it's the right thing to do.
No, fair play. I absolutely agree with you. And I think that it's, you know, it is an area that we all need to step up on, you know, because it is a reflection of a, you know, we talk about a sick society, you know, a society with its priorities absolutely, you know, all wrong, that you leave the most vulnerable. And as you say, parents who dedicate, you know, absolutely their lives are dedicated to their children and trying to, you know, do the best they can with, you know, the limited resources that are there, and it absolutely needs to change. So I completely agree with you on that. And maybe, do you want to, our time is running on, do you want to mention the assessment of needs work you're doing briefly, maybe?
Yeah, I suppose that's been something that both our psychological society, the occupational therapists and speech and language therapists have been advocating for probably about 2 years now since some of these changes came into place. So the assessment of need is an assessment that comes under the Disability Act, where you've a statutory entitlement to an assessment of what your children's needs are. And again, it doesn't entitle you to intervention, but what has happened is that the standards by which those assessments were conducted were dramatically reduced down to 60 to 90 minutes. And there is no clinician that can identify quite complex needs within the child within that time frame. So it's what we've been calling for before the Oireachtas and with various politicians in the HSE, is that it needs to be stopped, because of what's happening and what we're seeing from speaking to colleagues and from a survey that we hope to release in the next probably 10 days or so, is that clinicians are leaving disability services because they're being expected to work within a system that is no longer meeting children's needs, but is placing an unbearable expectation on clinicians that they can decide in 60 minutes, does a child have a disability or not? And that does a disservice, and it's disrespectful to the families to suggest that you could. And what's happening in reality is that a child is waitlisted for this preliminary team assessment, and the outcome of that assessment is they need more assessment. And that's just putting an additional bureaucratic barrier in place that slows down what's really needed, which is what we touched on, which is assessment. Or intervention. They need the support. They need the therapy to actually address the needs that are identified. But what we've done is we've diluted the standard in identifying what those needs are. So we need to spend extra time now doing further assessment to make sure we know what the right needs are, to then waitlist for further assessment. So these children, these families, they deserve better.
And I think, no, it's very clear, you know, from what you're saying in overall, that it is about the intervention. And again, it is the resourcing, you know, and these families absolutely do deserve better. So, you know, I'd really like to thank you for your work on that. And it is very important. And, you know, we will continue to advocate on this as well. You know, around these services are absolutely inadequate and need to be resourced properly. And I think that our listeners will absolutely agree with you, and we'll, you know, call on our listeners another thing to contact your TDs and counsellors about, and, you know, to try and change this. Just to finish up, in terms of, I suppose, you know, these are difficult, challenging times for all of us. What would you say are kind of two or three things we could do to draw on your practice and expertise to get us through the next few weeks and months in a positive, try and put us in a bit of a positive without being like, you know, ignore reality.
all fluffy and, you know, look for the silver lining.
Yeah.
And it's, I think the main thing, and that goes across parenting, but surviving this too, is just being compassionate towards ourselves and others. Being monitoring kind of our stress levels, our irritation levels, and noticing when maybe we need to just take a step back. But also, I think one of the most consistent things that I think has been important is to just to validate our own emotions and to see that, look, yeah, I'm struggling and I'm anxious and I'm stressed, and that's okay. That's understandable. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not, you know, this is how you're supposed to feel in this situation, and it's unpleasant, but it's understandable. But also, I think that to have some sense of hope collectively, that we can all find these outliers where we see negative things about maybe vaccine rollouts or the numbers that are there, or people are doing something wrong that's all over social media. And we tend to focus on that and it reinforces how we feel. But there are also times where you go on Twitter and you see laughing babies or puppies doing funny things, and just to go back to seeking the, you know, the joy in those little moments. It doesn't mean that the world around us still isn't in crisis, but that in that moment, that's okay and it's nice, and we give ourselves that time to just sit with the silly and to enjoy it for what it is.
That's lovely. So you're telling me it's okay if I post some more laughing videos of my babies?
As many as possible. Bring them on.
That's good to hear. No, it is. I think that's some really, you know, really good advice around, yeah, it is trying to get through each day. I think the compassion is a really, really important idea and something we need to try and work on to go easy on ourselves and to find the little bits of joy that are around us and to be hopeful. You know, we will as a society get through this. And I think what's really important about these conversations, and I really appreciate you taking the time out, is that, you know, through this pandemic, we need to see what type of society do we want coming out of it and into the future, and trying to, you know, learn from it and by help each other getting through it as a society. So Mark Smith, I'm really delighted to have you again on Reboot Republic. It was great conversation, and hopefully you'll come back again, maybe.
Quite possibly. Thanks, Rory.
No, it was brilliant. Thank you so much. I know the listeners will really enjoy that. And a reminder, shout out to our listeners, you can support us to keep producing these podcasts. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Give us whatever you can each month. A fiver, a tenner, 20 euro, whatever you can to help us keep going producing these podcasts. It does cost to produce, and thank you very much. And we look forward to talking to you soon.